Even your interviewing for the job up here is an interesting story.
Yeah, there's sort of a double angle on this. It's good luck and bad luck, because jobs were, there were a few around, but I had an MA in creative writing from UBC, and I was delivering pizzas in Vancouver, and I thought, well, you know, I've got this degree, I'll apply for at least two or three jobs that I'd seen advertised. So there was one back east for a Canadian literature instructor, and I thought, well, I can probably do that, but I didn't really have a huge background. I had a degree in psychology, and a BA, and then took creative writing, which, you know, involved an extensive reading list and lots of paper writing and so forth. But anyway, the creative writing job was advertised in Prince George, so I applied for that. I didn't sign the letter. However, I did
the letter, meaning
the letter of application, which meant that, according to the guy who hired me, the German fellow, that it, ordinarily he would have thrown it in the wastebasket. It was like an unsolicited letter, and I was just in a hurry and didn't sign it. And in those days, you know, you're working with a typewriter and whiteout, and the tedium, I mean, you'd forget to sign a letter.
Did they have whiteout by then? I don't think they even had
Well, we had that tape.
Tape, right.
The
right,
tape
right,
whiteout.
Right.
And I seem to remember that. You're right, I think the actual liquid whiteout came a little later. So I got a phone call, and he was interviewing over a couple of days and for everybody, all positions, and he slotted me in at midnight at the Vancouver Hotel. And I just got off shift delivering pizzas and got down to the hotel. And as I was saying yesterday, I was a chain smoker at the time, and I got up to his room, and there was an ashtray sitting there, but there was no smell of smoke, and there were no cigarettes in the ashtray or butts. So I thought, I don't know, my instincts were really pretty good, because I thought, I'm not going to whip out a cigarette. And in those days, people smoked everywhere. I mean, I'd smoke at the swimming pool. You know, I'd put a cigarette down at the end of the pool, do a lap, and then take a drag on the way back. We smoked in classes. You know, it was insane. So did the interview, and he said, ordinarily, I don't look at these applications. I'll be in touch with you in a few days. And sure enough, I got a phone call, and would you like the job? And we said, yeah. And packed up a 57 Plymouth, and we left most of our, you know, thrift store furniture in Vancouver. I do remember, as I was saying yesterday, we brought up an ironing board for some reason. And got to Prince George about July 15th, 90 degrees. Hot, stinky, and Joy started to cry immediately. Went to a pay phone, started phoning a friend saying that she was coming back. Couldn't handle it. It's just the shock of driving into Prince George, the heat and the stink and logging trucks, and people were kind of drunk all the time. No matter when or what time of day you were here, there were people staggering around. So it was a tough logging mill town, you know. And so we'd come from Vancouver and Montreal, where there's a more of a bohemian scene, you know, that we had a lot of fun in. But the story was, I said, well, let's go have a drink mid-afternoon. And so we drank two or three of these Uncle Ben's beer. It was literally 12% alcohol. He was a local brewer and a local millionaire entrepreneur. And so we drank this stuff and came out in the parking lot, and the sun was shining, the air had cleared up, and I looked around and I said, this isn't so bad. So we kind of, in a day, started to adjust to the idea that we were going to stay for at least a while. I mean, you could leave, you know, at the end of a year or break the contract. And then within a few days, all the teachers started to show up, the lecturers, and we didn't call ourselves professors, but Charlie Boylan, and there was a math genius who was, you know, nutty as hell, and everybody wanted to get together, so we'd go to the bar, and they'd say, what's with this German principal, man? Like, this guy is weird. Well, he was. He had the idea of setting up basically a strong humanities core in an industrial town, with the idea of, as the German colonial activity, you know, civilizing the world by bringing art, culture, and philosophy and whatever. But of course, his idea was, for music, was the, you know, the violin concerto. For poetry, it must have had something to do with something way out of line with what I was doing, because he didn't like the writing when he saw it. So he was expecting, I don't know what, more traditional kind of writing, I guess. So in other words, that word community and calling it a community college came together within a week. It was just it was like a magnetized force. And
So he had some good taste in the people he
had,
bringing.
He had excellent taste. But
and what was his name?
Wolfgang Franke, F-R-A-N-K-E. But on the other hand, that the notion of liberal arts was also sort of countered by his rigid thinking in other matters. Like, we were called masters of English, masters of philosophy, and we had to wear suits, jackets at least. You know, a friendly guy, and I kind of liked him, at the same time feared him, because he was an authoritarian. He'd come up and tell me to get my hair cut, or that, you know, the jacket I was wearing, I had a corduroy jacket with patches, you know, which was part of the costume for an English teacher in those days, mm-hmm. and a Penny's blue work shirt, you know, mm-hmm. with a thin black tie, blue jeans. And he grabbed my arm and said, you know, are you going to fix that? And so he was kind of meddling in everything. And one day after class, one of my students had his... We kept the discussion going, and the student had his feet up on the desk, and he was walking by, and he came in and started yelling at this kid, show some respect, you know. And I said, hey, the class is over, you know, this is... So that was kind of the tension that he created. And in terms of the town that really didn't want liberal arts, I mean, I can say that as a generalization, there was a lot of resistance to what he was up to. They literally got rid of him in the first year and wanted to revert to a more technical kind of trade school model. And in a sense, we were starting to get squeezed very early on, and it really, we hit the wall in 1980 when they did bring in a guy who cut music, philosophy, art, creative writing, Canadian literature, I think, on down the line. And so we ended up teaching a core of university transfer courses and technical writing and career English. So Frankie was an interesting guy in that he did have a vision, but it wasn't matching what the town was sort of up to. For instance, the mayor at that time, when there was a referendum for a new library, said publicly, and I tried to search this because I'm sure it's in print, but he said that this town doesn't need another library. It had a little kind of hole in the wall downtown. He said, libraries are for loafers. So that's what we were up against. And these guys, the mayors and the mill guys and the guys with these, you know, gypo outfits who were millionaires and who had a lot of say in the town, had a lot of say. And they could put a lot of pressure on how things worked here. Now, you know, eventually, like I say, in 1980, which is... many years later, the cuts came, and we were pretty much reduced to just a core handful of faculty. So that initial vision, and that initial excitement was, you know, dissipated. It became, I stopped putting on poetry readings at that point because our workloads increased. You know, we'd go from maybe 60 students to, I remember one semester, my worst semester, I had 140 students in English. So the marking and the scheduling was night teaching, morning teaching. And I remember my kids were looking at me kind of like, where's my dad? You know, while I was marking bloody papers on Jack Frost, the nature poet. You know? And I'd take my kid out to the ski hill, and every once in a while, between papers, I'd look up to see how he was skiing. I couldn't ski with him because I was locked into this incredibly, for me, stressful and heavy workload. So the poetry, that kind of public work, went out the window. I couldn't do it anymore.